I noticed that my audience has dwindled down a little, at least, to what I consider a hardcore group. Okay, and just looking at the people who have shown up today, I can sense that you already know quite a little bit of macroeconomics and have studied it. And I'm going to take advantage of that during this period, because I'm going to present several different analytical apparatuses that you'll probably recognize, but that I won't have time to explain in full, although I'll say a few things in order to anchor my own thoughts into the various pieces of analysis I look at. So I would invite you during the lecture, if something is totally bizarre and you don't understand what in the world's on the screen, you can speak up and ask questions about it. Program announces this lecture as Extensions and Applications of Austrian Macroeconomics, and I take that to be pretty open-ended. It allows me to do several different things. And what I think is helpful to do and kind of fun to do is something similar to what I did yesterday. If you attended my lecture yesterday, what you could see that we looked at Keynesian theory, and eventually showed what modifications were necessary to get it to morph into Austrian theory. And in my view, that's a good way of understanding both Keynesian theory and Austrian theory. And I want to do something very similar today for monetarism. And it's even a little more fun because I can actually draw on some of Friedman's own theories, and which causes us to wonder, why isn't he sympathetic with the Austrians? I don't know. I think that there's still a big question in my mind. I have some hints about it. But also in this lecture, I want to point out what I call the many faces of monetarism. It's not quite a coherent whole, partly because monetarism is virtually framework independent. I use that phrase in my book. That is a fairly narrow doctrine having to do with the quantity of money and the overall level of prices. And once it gets beyond that basic relationship, it can bring in all sorts of aspects of the economy, many of which are not consistent one with the other. So we'll take a look at that too. Now, along the way, I do hope also to give Friedman his due. I think that we owe a lot to Friedman for some of the positive contributions he has made, and I'll try to point those out. So we'll start out in that direction, actually, the many faces of monetarism. And Friedman's monetarism, which really is a very narrow monetarism, especially when the monetarists are in a defensive mode. When they're defending their theories, they defend a fairly narrow theory. And it's anchored to this equation of exchange, something that predates Friedman by many decades, but Friedman is to be credited for reviving it and for using it as a counter to the Keynesian doctrine, which had become dominant at the time that Friedman launched his monetarist counter-revolution. Monetarist counter-revolution dates to the mid-50s, 1956 or so, when a seminal article by Friedman was published. So you've seen this equation before in my earlier lectures. MV equals PQ, quantity of money times its velocity of circulation, is equal to the overall price level times the real output in the economy. And according to Friedman, with a mild upward trend in velocity, about which more later on an empirical level, and output growing slowly, then the price level P moves with the money supply M. And, of course, in one sense, it's a matter of arithmetic, a matter of the algebra. If you look at if V is constant or nearly so and Q is constant or nearly so, then any movements in M and P have to be together, okay? I say a slight upward trend, but I'll show it here as constant or near constant, which allows for the slight upward trend. Quantity is constant or near constant, allowing for the slow growth. And then we get the relationship not only that M and P move together, but when M goes up, P goes up. In other words, the direction of causation is from M to P. That's also an integral part of the Friedman's monetarism. And strangely enough, I think even strange to Friedman himself and almost implausible to the beginning student, it takes a long time. Okay, so there's a lag there of about 18 or 30 months. And that, as we'll see later on, gives the Austrians an end. It allows the Austrians to show what's going on between that 18 or during that 18 to 30 months, which looks much more Hayekian than it does Friedmanian. Okay, so this is Friedman's monetarism, and the only framework here, of course, is the equation of exchange. The lion's share of the empirical work that was done during the late 50s and throughout the 60s in the monetarist workshop at Chicago and at universities in later years that were populated by Chicago graduates, studies in monetarism were empirical studies, and they all took a similar form, and that is that showing that in a particular time period and in a particular country, the velocity of money didn't change very much, which is another way of saying the demand for money doesn't change very much. The amount of money people tend to hold, given their incomes and wealth levels, remains pretty stable. That's what's indicated by constant velocity. I have attended workshops. Was a guest at the University of Chicago at one time and another one at Stanford University at one time. And the people working on the monetary theory at the time were explaining what they were doing, and we go around the table and who's doing what. And in virtually every instance, after about the third or fourth graduate student explained what he was doing, the next one would just name the country and name the time period, and you knew what he was doing. He was looking at the money supply during that period. He was looking at the other statistics and showing that the velocity of money didn't change much during that period. So that's what it amounted to. So the focus, the empirical focus, was on the demand for money. Now, it's not hard to see that the conclusions were about the supply side. In other words, if you see erratic behavior stemming from some monetary cause, and you know that the demand for money is relatively stable, then where must be the instability? Namely, on the supply side. So it's the supply of money that causes the problem. So all of the empirical focus on the demand for money had the effect of focusing attention on the supply of money as the source of the instability in the economy. And there's two things came out of this. One was it was counter to Keynes, because Keynes thought that there was instability in the demand for money. That's the nature of his notion of a fetish of liquidity or a propensity to hoard money, the building up of cash hoards or the drawing down of cash hoards, a demand for money that flops around. If you draw an ISLM curve, the demand for money is unstable. It can flop around quite a little bit. And Friedman was there with the evidence to say, not so, Keynes. It's not so. The evidence doesn't bear you out. Okay? The demand for money is stable. If there are problems on the supply side, that's the central bank, and it's not a market problem. It's a policy problem with the central bank. And to that, we can credit Friedman. I think that he more than anybody else, shifted the attention away from so-called fetishistic behavior with regards to holding money to politically oriented behavior with regard to supplying money. Okay? It's an important shift and one we should all welcome. He also, using the same empirical studies, gave support to the proposition, probably the most famous quote from Friedman, that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. And that comes from the fact of investigating the other possible source, which would be changes in the demand for money, and showing that it didn't change. Okay, it doesn't change much. And so the inflation doesn't come from people dishoarding money. It comes from the central bank supplying money. Now, it's just a short distance from this observation or this empirically demonstrated truth. Maybe before I leave this slide, I should point out that in earlier lectures, I've been critical about this notion of keeping the price level constant. Now let's go to the next slide. Yeah, oh, I just got Friedman's monetary rule. His rule is increase the money supply at a slow and steady rate so as to achieve long-run price level constancy. In other words, if V is trending upward slightly and Q is trending upward slightly, well, okay, then let M trend upward a little in order to keep the price level constant, okay, just offset whatever differential effect there is relative to V and Q. A few lectures ago, I was critical of that in that increasing the money supply to keep the price level constant still gives you problems because you're increasing it by pumping money out through credit market, lowering the interest rate, and giving rise to a business cycle. So I'll mention that, but that's not what my focus is here this morning. So that's Friedman's monetary rule. Now, to implement this rule, it requires a pretty definite definition of money. What does constitute money? And let me see where I go from here. I might not want to go to the next slide yet. I'll just leave that there for a minute. In the heyday of monetarism, and this would be during the 60s and into the 70s, a time when the velocity of money was in fact pretty stable with a slight upward trend, money was well defined. And during the period, people tend to overlook just why it was well defined, but it turned out to be a very important consideration. During that period, in fact, dating clear back from the 30s and the monetary reforms that followed the crash of 29, the Federal Reserve regulated money and deposits of various kinds with a whole list of regulations that were identified by the letter. You had Regulation A and Regulation B and on down the line. And there was one regulation down there called Regulation Q. They had a lot of regulations. Reg Q. Regulation Q that pretty much hamstrung financial institutions into offering particular kinds of deposits and being careful not to blur the distinction between the kinds of deposits. And what I have in mind here is that Regulation Q specified really two things. One is that interest cannot be paid on demand deposits. Okay, it was illegal to pay interest on demand deposits. And the other side of that coin, which really is another way of saying the same thing, is that savings deposits, which do draw interest, cannot be checkable deposits. Okay, so you can have deposits which you can draw interest on and write checks on, but you can't draw interest and write checks on the same deposit. Right? You have to have one deposit you write checks on, another deposit you draw interest on. Right? And that was a pretty hard and fast rule. It applied to commercial banks and to all other lending institutions. They weren't allowed to have checkable deposits at all. So you couldn't have a checkable deposit at savings and loan or savings bank or anything other than commercial bank chartered by the state or the federal government. Okay. So that regulation then gave us a hard and fast distinction between what's money and what's not. Okay. What's money is that stuff you can write checks on, and what's not is that other stuff that you can't write checks on, although you can draw interest on. Right? So you have that sort of black and white kink in the curve distinction between the different kinds of deposits. And that's what gave us that crisp definition of the money supply. In fact, that definition was called M1. It included those checkable accounts, how much checking account money is there in the economy, plus currency and pocket change and so on. So you add those things up and you have money, meaning M1, okay, or it was called M1. That was money, and anything beyond that, savings accounts or time deposits of different kinds or bonds or whatever, that's not money, right? And it's critical that distinction be maintained. And so with a well-behaved velocity and a well-defined money supply, then at least it was possible to choose a monetary rule and implement it and stick with it. And I have no doubt that the economy would have performed better had that rule been adhered to than had it been flouted and instead had manipulation of one sort or another of interest rates and discretionary monetary policy of one sort or another. The whole battle between rules versus discretion, the debates between Friedman and Heller and so on, I think all of us could have easily come down on the side of Friedman in those debates. Of course, Heller was the Keynesian, so it wasn't hard to choose. There wasn't any Austrian in the debate. But things have changed. Things have changed, and we can date the change to the early 80s. Let me show you a plot of velocity. And I take my plot, so you don't think I've rigged the statistics somehow, I take it from Brad Long, published an article in Journal of Economic Perspectives a few years ago. I plotted my own curve, which matches his, and if you keep going, the curve keeps doing jig-jag things into the future, so it doesn't change the pattern. But what you can see on this curve is look at the heyday of monetarism. Here's the 60s and 70s, and sure enough, there's velocity, which is the darker line, okay, the purple line shows you sort of the general trend, okay, and all of those empirical studies showed that velocity didn't much deviate from that trend, okay, that was the whole idea. Velocity doesn't change much apart from the upward trend, which is exaggerated here, just to get the scale, give you a visible visual illustration of what's going on. But then something happened in the early 80s. There's 1980 right there. Something happened here to cause velocity to start performing erratically. It won't do to say, oh, we have a new trend and it's more horizontal, because that curve isn't very close to any trend line, is it? Sometimes way above it, sometimes way below it, and so on. It's not close enough to have policy relevance as being overall constant, okay? It's not a zigzag up, first up and down, and so on. So what happened in this early 80s period, late 70s, early 80s? And what happened was the phasing out and elimination of Regulation Q, okay? Regulation Q gave rise to some interesting incentives in the late 70s. Where market rates of interest were very high, and banks were constrained on what interest they could pay on savings accounts and so on. And so there emerged markets from money market mutual funds and certificates of deposits and all sorts of things to skirt around those regulations. And eventually the government recognized that the regulations weren't being complied with anyhow, so they eliminated Regulation Q. So now banks could pay interest on checking accounts. They could allow you to write checks on savings accounts. And the distinction was gone. The crisp definition was gone. If we still record the data on M1, but if you look at the M1 velocity of money, which is plotted here, it's very erratic. So the whole empirical basis on which monetarism was based is gone. Okay? It's gone. Which I've called the irony of monetarism. I think I put that on the screen. Okay, velocity of money became unstable after 1980. That phasing out of Reg Q was actually initiated under the Carter administration and then accelerated under the Reagan administration. So Friedman's policy lost its velocity anchor. Federal Reserve abandoned money supply targeting in favor of interest rate targeting. Right? So now all the time when you hear about Greenspan and his policy, what's he likely to do next? You never hear about what money growth rule is he likely to adopt or what money growth rate is he likely to target. You don't hear that. That would be a monetarist rule or monetarist kind of a policy. What you hear instead is what interest rate that he's going to target and what discount rate he's going to set. Okay, so the policy since actually before Greenspan took office, is all interest rate targeting, right? You can see where interest rate is in that equation, right? It's not there. It's not there. So what's the monetarist framework going to do with analyzing changes in interest rates in a framework that doesn't include the interest rates? what I've called the irony of monetarism, and I really don't see this anywhere else. It's my term to call it the irony, but I don't even see the proposition anywhere else. The monetary rule that allows the economy to perform at its laissez-faire best, according to the monetarists, presupposes a critical piece of intervention, okay, namely regulation Q, that makes the money supply operationally definable and makes the velocity relatively stable, all right? So that is sort of an irony. So if he loses that piece of intervention, no longer can even prescribe a monetary rule, let alone follow it. Monetarists were slow to recognize this, that all during the early part of Greenspan's term, many terms, monetarists were always critical that he wasn't following monetary rule. And there were monetarists on the staff of the joint of the JEC. What is that? Council or the Joint Economic Committee, the House and Senate, the committee that has Greenspan testify periodically and ask him questions about why is he doing this or why is he not doing that. And one of the questions, probably within a couple of years after Greenspan took office, one of the questions was, why aren't you following a monetary rule? Why aren't you at least paying attention to the growth rate of the money supply rather than targeting interest rates? And Greenspan's answer was very, very interesting and very revealing. I think I've got it on the screen next. Greenspan says, "We don't know what money is anymore." Okay, which in the context of my lecture, you know what he means. What's the right definition of the money supply? It can't be M1. That thing is just kind of gone silly. And what is it? Is it M2, M3? At one point, they had M's defined up to M13. After which, they started using letter designations. There's something called MZM. That the St. Louis Fed keeps track of, but which one do you look at? Even during the heyday of monetarism, we had all of these different M's, but they all tend to move up and down together. It didn't really matter which one you target. But after deregulation in the 1980s, then the M's move at odd angles to one another. Some go up, some go down. They go up and down at different rates, and so on. If you want to watch the money supply, which one do you watch? And this is Greenspan's point, that we don't know which one to watch anymore. Don't know what money is anymore. But the way he said it, here you had the chairman of the Federal Reserve who doesn't know what money is anymore. And it's a line that got quoted even by Jay Leno on The Tonight Show. You know, we're wondering if we've got the right guy at this job. You know, at least we've got somebody who knows what money is. Okay. But it explains why the Federal Reserve then switched from money supply targeting to interest rate targeting in the early 80s. But note here that Q in MB equal PQ, Q literally quantity, but real output, the quantity of output, level of output of what? Well, of everything. Okay, it's a real gross domestic product called final output of all consumer goods, investment goods in the economy. So, in other words, it lumps together both consumption and investment. I've written it here as Q sub C plus Q sub I because it's quantity terms and not expenditure magnitudes. So the division between consumption and investment is glossed over. It's eclipsed. Those two things have been put together and just called Q. And yet we're trying to analyze what's going on as the interest rate changes, which is now what the Federal Reserve uses because they can't use the money supply anymore. So with the effect of interest rate changes on relative movements in C and I, and certainly on the pattern of investment, is just no part of the theory. It can't be because C and I have been smashed together into a single aggregate called Q, right? Sometimes I like to make the point in comparing all three, this Keynesianism, monetarism, and Austrianism, that what we see is that the Keynesians have a level of aggregation, C and I, that at least allows them to see a problem, Okay, there's a problem in the economy. C needs to get coordinated with I, and yet it isn't, because it's driven by animal spirits and habits and so on. There's two ways to go there. You could either increase the level of aggregation and get rid of the problem, you know, where you can't see the problem either. Okay? And that's what the monitors do. Or you can decrease the level of aggregation, like Hayek does in multiple stages of production, where you can see the market forces that can solve the problem. All right? So Friedman is operating at a higher level of aggregation even than the Keynesians, and in effect putting into eclipse the very issues that divide the Keynesians from the Austrians. He just calls it Q. Okay. Now, just in terms of monetary theory, it's hard to press much beyond where I've already gone. I've got MB equal PQ. That's really the whole story. That's the basis of the story. And so when Friedman, particularly, and monetarists in generally, begin telling stories about what must be going on in the economy while this economy is adjusting to an increase in the money supply, what can they talk about? They don't have a level of aggregation that allows them to focus in on anything, and they end up talking about labor markets and distortions in labor markets that are based on faulty perceptions of inflation. And so instead of having a monetary theory here, it's not really monetary theory at all, it's a theory of labor market dynamics, sort of a unique, particular theory of labor market dynamics. How could labor markets be working in such a way to give us the kind of results that we seem to observe? And that's where I want to go next, a theory of labor market dynamics. One of the few monetarists that, that points this out is David Laidler, who I mentioned the other day as a Canadian monetarist, that he's a little bit critical of Friedman's monetarism for this very reason. He says, well, this is not really monetary theory, it's theory of labor market dynamics, and it might stand or fall on that basis, but that's what the theory is. So let's see if I can explain this theory of labor market dynamics. It goes like this. We have inflation of the money supply. In other words, the Fed increases the money supply. Now, in recent times, what we would say is the Fed targets a low rate of interest because they're interest rate targeting. But how do they target the low rate of interest? By pumping money into the credit markets until they've driven them down that much. Okay, so you get the increase in the money supply. They're just not keeping tabs on what that increase is, pumping enough in so to get the interest rate where they want it to be. Okay, so pump in money, get the interest rate down. Of course, that causes inflation, starts increasing prices, and so on. So prices create a discrepancy between perceived wages, wages as perceived by the employer, and wages as perceived by the employee. Let's see how that works. Okay, the real wage rate as perceived by the employer, and the real wage rate as perceived by the employee. And it's not that one or the other is just better at perceiving things. That's not it. Okay? Friedman makes it clear that here's what's going on. The individual producer is producing, say, one product. He's producing widgets or whatever it is. And he can't help but notice that the price he can get for his widgets is higher. There's no perception problem here, is there? If you can get more for it, fine. You're happy about it. You sell your widgets at a higher price. And you see that. But nothing yet has happened to the wage rate. And so the wage rate is lower in real terms. In other words, compared to what he can get for widgets, the wage rate's lower. All right? So he just sees that, well, okay, at a lower wage rate, I'll hire more workers. Okay? And he might hire more workers even if he has to bid up the nominal wage rate, just because if he doesn't bid it up as far as the price of widgets, he's still getting a good deal, isn't he? So he might bid up the nominal wage rate a little bit to hire more workers and still be making out quite well because he's selling widgets at a higher price. Right? So from the employer's point of view, he's just moving down along that demand curve for labor. He wants more labor because it's cheaper in terms of what he's producing, namely the widgets. All right? Now, okay, there it is. The employer sees the wage rate falling with respect to output prices. But now let's look at the employee. What does he see? He sees, but only belatedly, the falling real wage. So the first thing the employee sees is that he's getting a higher nominal wage. All right? And he mistakes that for a higher real wage. Because he's got a lot more things to look at than widgets. In fact, he might not even buy any widgets or care about what the price of those things are. But he buys a whole basket of consumer goods, some of whose prices are going up, some of whose prices are going down. And it's beyond him what the average of prices is. Nobody, including the employer, can perceive that very quickly to see the change in those average prices of all those goods. So from the employee's standpoint, it looks to him like the real wage has risen, because the nominal wage has risen, and he hasn't yet caught on to the fact that prices in general are rising. Okay, so let's see. So initially, employee sees a rising real wage. Okay, so now with the arrows there, I show there's the real wage in the employer's view, and there's the real wage in the employee's view. So you have sort of a double disequilibrium depending on these two different perceptions. But in just setting it out that way, you see it's not going to last. It's going to be temporary. And you can also see, though, that in both cases, the quantity of labor supplied has increased. Okay, so you get more people working. The employer, because he thinks he's getting wages cheaper, and the employee, because he thinks he's getting wages higher. Okay, so that's the nature of the boom. So what I want you to see here is that there's a boom-bust story being told. Yeah, you get a boom and a bust, and the boom comes from this misperception, sort of a double misperception of the real wage, and it eventually comes undone because eventually workers straighten out their perceptions about what the real wage is. And once they discover that they can't buy even as much now as they used to, then there's a reaction to that, and you get back to the old supply and demand for labor. You get some people maybe that were bid into the labor force as secondary workers in the household because it looked like a good deal. Now, it's not such a good deal, so they resume their role in the household rather than in the labor force. Or on the other hand, you'll get at wage negotiation time, people negotiating for cost of living increases to fix the problem that they now finally perceive, namely that the average prices of goods and services are going up. Okay, so it all comes undone. Let's see. Oh, I'll point out with this slide that there's something strange about the whole thing, in that isn't it odd that the notable effects of an increase in the money supply impinge in the first instance on labor markets. Now, isn't it odd? Because the new money comes in through credit markets and initially impinges on the interest rate. But where's that in this theory? It's nowhere in the theory. Okay, it's not there. It's nowhere, no part of it. So the money supply comes through credit markets, impinges on the interest rates, eventually bids up prices, which affect differentially the perception of the real wage. And that is what causes the boom, according to Friedman. Right? So it's a very contorted theory, very constrained, a very strained theory, just in its own right. And then probably as telling or more telling, it should be more telling to the monetarist, it doesn't line up with the data. And this should be more of a critique of monetarism from their point of view maybe than it is from my own. But the theory implies that the real wages are actually low during the boom, okay? Because the perception on the part of the employees is a misperception, right? The employer, what he's seeing is actually there. In other words, he's selling real widgets for a high price, and he's buying labor at a lower price, and he's making a bigger profit. That's all real stuff, okay? And so the real wages are low during the boom. And the worker finally figures this out, and that's what gives you the bust. And so one empirical test is to say, well, are real wages generally low during economic booms? And, of course, the answer is no. Real wages tend to be high during economic booms. And, in fact, if they weren't, creating artificial booms wouldn't be nearly as politically popular as it actually is. It's not hard to see that the reason that the booms are generated are precisely to make people do better, if only temporarily, than they otherwise would have. So it's at odds with the empirical record. And then here is a piece of analysis that most of you will recognize as short-run, long-run Phillips curve analysis. A.W. Phillips showed an empirical relationship between inflation rate and the unemployment rate, and those things appear to be trade-offs one against the other. And that downward sloping curve is a short-run Phillips curve, meaning that there's, to some extent, you can trade unemployment for inflation or inflation for unemployment. And in fact, this labor market dynamics was devised to show how that trade-off gets made. That starting at this point, where you have actually some inflation already, there's an increase in the money supply, and workers misperceive the increase in the nominal wage as an increase in the real wage, and so they work more, and that reduces unemployment. So that business of more people working is just a reduction in unemployment, so a movement leftward. But inflation is underway, prices are going up, and the economy moves in this direction until workers eventually straighten out their perceptions of the real wage. Then some leave the labor market, others demand cost of living adjustments and so on, and the economy returns to a point now with higher inflation, but with the same level of employment and no misperceptions. Okay, so that's the dynamic. The labor market dynamics will trace out that particular path put us on a point on the long-run Phillips curve, which is vertical. This is one of Friedman's contributions to show that the long-run Phillips curve, in other words, after misperceptions have been straightened out, is not downward slope, is vertical. It's vertical. So in the long run, there's no trade-off between inflation and unemployment. And that's a pretty good view if the alternative is the Phillips curve itself and the supposed permanent trade-off between those two. It doesn't exist. And Friedman showed that was his famous 1967 address at the American Economic Association meetings. Note here, though, that the way I've shown you moving up a Phillips curve, looks like both prices and employment are moving at the same time. And in fact, to make the story stick, you would have to have inflation first. In other words, you have to have inflation for the wage rate to be misperceived to give you the lower unemployment. Isn't that right? I mean, that's the story. First there has to be inflation, then you misperceive it, and then you get the lower rate of employment. Okay, let's see a summary here. In response to an increase in the money supply, the economy moves up the short-run Phillips curve, but the curve itself shifts as workers straighten out their perceptions of the real wage. The long-run Phillips curve is vertical. Okay. Now let's look at that equation of exchange again and see what sense we can make out of it. And here I think I can reconcile in the direction of the Austrians. Q rises to the extent that P rises. Isn't that the story? In other words, why is Q rising at all? Well, because the more people are working, making things. Why are they making things? Well, because they're misperceiving an ongoing inflation. Well, the ongoing inflation has to get ongoing before they can misperceive it and then go to work and produce things. Isn't that right? So the logic of the system has prices rising first and causing output to be dragged along behind it. But if you look at MV equal PQ, you see on this side of the equation, P times Q, it's pretty clear that if M goes up, some combination of P and Q has to go up. And can't you say that one goes up to the extent the other doesn't? In other words, if it's only P, then Q can't rise. Or if it's only Q, then P can't rise. Right? So in that sense, it's hard to make the case that Q goes up to the extent that P goes up. But quite the contrary, Q goes up to the extent that P doesn't go up. In fact, one of the fundamental propositions of monetarism, and here's a direct contradiction within the school itself, as set out by Friedman, is that in the initial stages of a monetary expansion, Q rises first with prices hardly moving at all. Well, I think that's empirically correct. But if it's correct, then you can't really explain that rise in Q by some misperception of inflation which hasn't yet occurred. Okay? Now, the timing is a little faulty there. So Q rises to the extent that P does not rise, and initially P doesn't rise at all, and so Q goes up. Okay, the two claims together, though, and here's my reconciliation, the two claims together suggest a self-reversing process. Okay, there's a boom-bust story being told here. It's being told in terms of labor market dynamics, which I think is not the best setting to tell the story, but here it is. So in the face of an increased money supply, Q rises, as does P. So you got Q rising, and Q even rising first, but P starting to rise too. But then Q falls to its initial level as P becomes fully adjusted to the higher M. So you can see that self-reversing process. Look, here's P and here's Q. So what happens? Q starts rising. P rises too. If there's misperception, it gives a boost to Q, but Q will fall back down to its original level after P has become fully adjusted to the money supply. That gives you the boom and the bust as the price level is adjusting to that new money supply. Okay? And that can be a significant boom and bust if it really takes 18 to 30 months for P to rise all the way up to that subsequent level, doesn't it? You've got 18 months to play with. That's the political time to play with to get the boom until the bust comes. Okay. Now I'm going to throw another framework at you that some of you may not recognize, but I'll explain it very briefly. And it's kind of like, the monetarists deal with these issues seriatim, one at a time. In the Phillips curve theory, the interest rate is out of play. It's just nowhere in sight, and it's not to be factored in at all, period. But what does change is the level of employment, first rising and then falling due to these misperceptions. Is there no theory that the monetarists offer that involve a change in the interest rate? Well, yes, there is, but in that theory, the assumption is that the level of output remains constant throughout the whole adjustment. Okay? So this is a model offered by Don Patinkin. And he does it in terms of the interest rate. See, finally we've got the interest rate in the picture and the price level. So you've got the price level in the picture. And the curves that you've shown there, neither of which I'll explain in full, except to say CC curve is the demand or is the commodities curve, commodity just being output, commodities, all kind of commodities, consumption goods, investment goods, and so on. And BB curve, that's bonds, which broadly stands for earning assets, investment goods, and so on, financial assets, bonds, and so on. And each curve then represents combinations of prices and interest that keeps bonds on the one hand or commodities on the other hand in equilibrium. Now, we can gloss over that because the key to this model is that it's a model that shows an initial equilibrium back here when those two curves used to intersect at that point, and then an increase in the money supply that brings forth an adjustment of prices to a higher level. And here we've got a half a P and P, and what we're assuming is that the money supply doubles and that eventually prices double from a half a P to P, which is thoroughly consistent, of course, with MV equal PQ. You get that right out of MV equal PQ. And the only additional thing you get here is that if you trace out the dynamics, and this is directly from Patinkin, I'm not adding it to the figure, it's directly from Patinkin. If you trace out the dynamics, the interest rate falls during the adjustment period, but rises to its original level once the equilibrium has been struck. And I can show you, let's look at it. In response to an increase in the money supply, prices are bid up as people try to purchase more output. Well, that explains why prices are rising, going to the right here, because prices are on the horizontal axis. Okay. But with no more output to purchase, and this is based on an assumed constancy of output, right? So you're not having more labor working, or you're not having more output produced. You really can't have a boom bust here, can you? Because output stays the same all the while. Where's the boom? So with no more output to purchase, people buy bonds instead. In other words, they're trying to buy commodities because they got more money, but there aren't any more commodities. And they don't want to hold all this money, so, well, okay, buy earning assets, buy bonds. But when you buy bonds, you put downward pressure on interest rates. Bond prices rise, interest rates fall. Isn't that right? Bond prices rise, interest rates fall. And that's what puts downward pressure on the interest rate. However, once you finally bid up prices of goods and services to fully adjust to the money supply, you no longer have this spillover demand for bonds and the interest rate, demand for bonds and the interest rate returns to its original level. All right? So with no more output to purchase, people buy bonds instead, driving the interest rate below its equilibrium level. In the long run, the prices fully adjust to the higher money supply and the interest rate returns to its initial level. Right? So if in the monetarist framework you assume a constant output, then the temporary change is strictly in terms of interest rates. But it has no effect. What effect could it possibly have in this model? Because output isn't changing, and you're not differentiating between consumption output and investment output, and certainly not differentiating among the various stages of production. So the interest rate has no effect, even though it's lower. So according to Patinkin, Q remains at its full employment level during the adjustment of price level and the interest rate. More specifically, the interest rate falls and then rises as price level becomes fully adjusted to the higher money supply. Note the interest rate is low for a period of 18 to 30 months without there being any effect on the makeup of output. Isn't that just implausible? Okay. Now, what I argue in time and money, let's see. Well, let's do the contrast verbally, and then I'll show you the graphics. Okay. So you got two alternative constructions here. One, the level of employment rises and then falls as the economy adjusts to an increase in the money supply, but the rate of interest remains out of play. Okay. Then in the other construction, the rate of interest falls and then rises as the economy adjusts to an increase in the money supply, but the economy remains at its full employment level throughout the adjustment. Okay. So all you have to do is put the two together, you see. Look at it closely. You got some point during the period here where unemployment rate is low, maybe the 3.9% that was achieved by Clinton during the 90s. Okay, unemployment rate is low, but there's no interest rate having any effect. If you look at the next one, you've got one point during the period, low point, where the interest rate is low, but no effect on employment or output. Okay. Now, if you put these two together, okay, you wonder if I go back here, they take this low point, low rate of interest here, that would correspond to that low rate of unemployment, which is a high rate of output. Wouldn't you think it would affect the kind of output that got placed, the division between consumption and investment, and the pattern of investment? You have to put these two curves together. Okay, see? So somehow, if you see it like this, you know, you'll get the Austrian view. Okay. Suppose each is half right. That's the way I like to do it. Suppose each is half right. And the rate of interest falls and then rises as the economy adjusts to an increase in money supply, while at the same time the level of employment rises and then falls. Okay? Whoop, missed that. Wouldn't the increase in labor input be allocated intertemporally in accordance with the relatively low rate of interest? Of course it would. Okay? And if it would, then you're going to get an Austrian story instead of a monetarist story. Now, I've searched around in Friedman to find some hint that he recognizes this. And sure enough, the article I was able to find, we'll read through this in a second, but let me just explain. He wrote this article, The Lag Effect in the Monetary Policy. Okay, and this is in Milton Friedman's Optimum Quantity. And it's a fairly short article, but what he's trying to account for is that lag. You remember at the beginning I said, well, why would it take so long, 18 to 30 months, for prices to adjust to the new money supply? It seems like he calls it a long and variable lag. Why should it be so long in a monetarist framework? What would explain that? And Friedman is trying to explain that. And tellingly, he's not explaining it in terms of labor, he's explaining it in terms of capital. And here I have about 2.5 screens, but it's worth reading because it really shows you how close he is to an Austrian view when he actually considers the reason for the length of the lag. Holders of cash, he says, will bid up the price of assets. If the extra demand is initially directed at a particular class of assets, say government securities or commercial paper or the like, the result will be to pull the prices of such assets out of line with other assets and thus widen the area into which the extra cash spills. The increased demand will spread sooner or later, affecting, look, equities, houses, durable producer goods, durable consumer goods, and so on, though not necessarily in that order. These effects can be described as operating on interest rates, he says. If a more cosmopolitan, of course he means Austrian, interpretation of interest rate is adopted rather than the usual one, which refers to a small range of marketable securities. So he's talking about assets. He didn't think in terms of a capital structure. But when he says assets and he says durable producer goods, you know, that's where the new money is going. Now look at this. He's thinking in terms of Frank Knight's theory of capital. Instead of having a structure of production that produces output, you've got a source called capital that's producing a flow called consumable output. Okay. The key feature of this process during which the interest rates are low is that it tends to raise the price of sources, that's capital, of both producer and consumer services relative to the prices of the services themselves. It is therefore encourages the production of such sources and at the same time the direct acquisition of the services. That's Friedman's malinvestment and overconsumption, okay, rather than of the source. But these reactions in their turn tend to raise the prices of the services, give the forced savings, relative to the prices of the sources, that is, to undo the initial effect of the interest rate. There is a self-reversing aspect. The final result may be a rise in expenditures in all directions without any change in the interest rate at all. Interest rates and asset prices may simply be the conduit through which the effect of monetary changes is transmitted to expenditures without altering it at all. So he ends up emphasizing the interest rate is right back where it used to be at the end of the process. Well, fine. It may or may not be right back where it used to be, but it'll be close. The point is that it was low during the 18 to 30 months, and that's what gave rise to the sorts of distortions he's talking about. One more half screen full, and it really drives the point home. Look at what he says. He says it may be that the monetary expansion induces someone within 2 or 3 months to contemplate building a factory within 4 or 5, that should be F-O-U-R, or 5, to draw up plans within 6 or 7 to get construction started. The actual construction may take another 6 months, and much of the effect on the income stream may come still later, insofar as initial goods used in construction are withdrawn from inventories and only subsequently lead to an increased expenditure by suppliers. So if you look at that, that's the pure Austrian view. So now here's another oddity of Friedman. If you put some of these things together, see, the only really boom-bust story he has is the Phillips curve thing, okay, the misperception of wages. The Patinkin thing is not really boom-bust because it doesn't have quantity varying. But so let's go to the boom-bust, the Phillips curve thing. So he's saying that the dynamics, what's going on, is this misperception of wages. But now why does it take so long for workers to straighten out their perceptions of the wages? Well, he shifts altogether and talks about capital and the effect of interest in a cosmopolitan sense, and justifies in the end ignoring the interest rate only because at the end of the process it's back to where it started. Okay? So, that's just a transitional matter. Okay. And yet if that explains the lag, then surely that has to be the theory of the process and not some misperception on the part of workers. Okay? Now what I like to do, you'll recognize that, I think. It kind of looks like my model in Time and Money. In fact, this is from Time and Money. But what I'm showing here is that if you do the whole thing in terms of labor market misperceptions, then you get those misperceptions both in the early stages and the late stages. You get increased output in all stages. You get the economy pushed beyond the PPF, but without any particular bias in terms of investment, because that's not part of the model. And then when those misperceptions are straightened out, the economy goes back to its initial position. Okay? And yet, if you factor in all of this discussion about why the lag is so long and what kind of things must be going on during the lag, of course you morph from there to there. You get the old boom bust like the Austrians suggested. Now, I can't resist saying a little bit about Friedman's plucking model, because this is a special story that actually emerges out of some early activities of the Mises Institute. It's kind of fun. Years ago, when the Review of Austrian Economics was just starting, Walter Block was an editor, he was a co-editor along with Murray Rothbard. And Block had a certain strategy for getting the Review of Austrian Economics off the ground. You think what you will about the strategy, but here it was. It's invite people that know something about the Austrian school, whether they're critical of it or whatever. Invite them, as long as they're well-known people, big-name people, invite them to write something about the Austrian view, why they reject it, and then get somebody else in the Austrian movement to counter that article. Okay, that was a strategy. It's a Blockian strategy. I mean, what can you say? Only Block would. So he wrote Friedman, and he said, "Would you write your criticisms of the Austrian theory of the trade cycle?" And Friedman wrote back, and he said, "No, I'm not going to address that issue again. I've already addressed it, and I have no more to say." Well, Block, being tenacious, writes back, "Oh, I'm sorry, I must have missed, where you criticized." And Friedman responded again. He said, "Oh, well, it was in an article written in, I think, 64, where it was a progress report of studies going on in the NBER. And Friedman obviously had gone back and checked this report now, and he said, "It wasn't quite as I reported." He says, I didn't mention the Austrian school. I didn't mention Mises or Hayek by name. But I thought you people would know who you are. You know, you'd recognize you're being criticized." And so Block bundled up the correspondence and sent it to me. And I went back and dug up the report to see what Friedman had said. And in that report, it's an amazing report, because he says that if you look at the data, he says, you really don't see booms and busts. There are no boom-bust cycles. What there are bust-boom cycles. You see the economy lapsing from secular growth and then recovering. Bust-boom. So it's not that the Austrians are so much wrong. They're irrelevant. They're trying to explain boom-bust cycles when there aren't any. There are bust-boom cycles. Again, it's in a category of proves too much, because what about Friedman's own long-run, short-run Phillips curve story? That's a boom-bust cycle. Did he mention that, by the way, there it goes too? Well, he actually offered that theory a few years later than throwing out wholesale all of the boom-bust theorizing. And so he introduced in that little report what he called a plucking model, which requires some explanation. Let me show you a picture of the plucking model. Only I draw the picture of it. Friedman just talks you through it. He says you have secular growth in the economy. That's the up long-term trend there. And he says, unfortunately, the economy doesn't always stay on track. Sometimes it's plucked loose from trend. And so he asks you to imagine a string glued to the underbelly of this plank. And a string, it has to be sort of a taffy-like string, is plucked down at various increments to various extent. And he says, that's the pattern of output you see. So you see bust and then boom. It's really bust and then recovery, isn't it, the trend? So he says, according to those Austrians, well, actually he doesn't mention Austrians, according to some who see a correlation between the size of the downturn and the size of the upturn, they're just not looking at the data. Because look, he says, here's the upturn, kind of a mediocre upturn, and then here's the downturn, it's pretty severe. Then here's a big upturn, and then a little downturn. Okay? They say people looking at from boom-bust theories think they can explain that bust in terms of that boom, or that bust in terms of that boom. They can't do it, because there's no correlation. All right? And that's his plucking model. I actually wrote something in a short article commenting on this, but then in later years, I realize I'm short of time, but I'll finish this up very quickly. On Friedman's 80th birthday, at the Western meetings, they invited him to present a paper which would be published in the Economic Inquiry. on monetary theory. Well, at that time, he hadn't dealt with monetary theory for years. But he had dealt with Bloch. Okay? And so for the purpose of that presentation, he took that section out of his old report and presented it almost verbatim. One of the few changes is that in about the end of the second paragraph, he writes, Mises and Hayek are prime examples here. And it came out as a lead article in 1993 in Economic Inquiry. Well, when that happened, you know, I sort of jumped up and clicked my heels to see Friedman now is, you know, back in print afresh with his plucking model. And so I felt justifiable to put the plucking model in time and money and deal with it. So it's a strange thing because now he's actually denying that there are such things as boom-bust cycles, and therefore we don't need a theory of them. I think that's the end of it. Oh, well, there's Friedman. What can you say? Okay, thank you very much.